Hi guys, thanks so much for coming today. I feel like I could be down there talking, but I'll stay up here. So thanks so much. I know that there are so many amazing things going on at South by Southwest, and I really appreciate that you took the time to learn more about the Congo and our connection to what's going on there. So I'm Sarah Fretwell. I'm a photojournalist, and I spent 50 days there last year visiting isolated communities, working with a Congolese nonprofit to learn more about the situation that's going on there and why it isn't changing after so many years. So what I want to do today is just share a little bit about my experience and some personal stories from the people that I met there, and then as well talk to you about our direct connection and what we can do to immediately impact the situation there. So I wanted to start with this quote. So people have looked to the Congo for over 100 years, and they've seen a great big pile of riches with some black people inconveniently sitting on top of them. It's your country and the developed world that's been doing this to Congo. So tell me, who are the savages? Us or you? And I think that's a really fitting quote, because with the heart of darkness and everything we know about the African continent and specifically Congo, that's the story that we hear over and over, that it's this savage, warring place, and our impression is, you know, it's a chaotic mess. And there is a lot going on there, but a lot of the reason that the conflict is going on is because of the outside world and not just the people living there. So I want to introduce the idea that our collective story, as in the Western world, and what we say about the Congo creates the reality of Congo. Because if we continue to say it's the worst place on earth to be a woman, it's a chaotic mess, it's a civil war, then that's all it ever will be. But what I want to propose to you is that it's time for us to change our collective story about the way that we're okay doing business in these resource-rich countries. Because it's really not just a story of Congo. It's a story of Congo in relation to the minerals that's in our technology, but this happens in every resource-rich country. So in case you didn't catch that, we're the savages, not them. And so, you know, what I want to ask you, because when I learned this, I'm really not okay with the fact that my technology that I really depend on to do this talk, to do my work, to drive around Austin, I'm not okay with the fact that it's fueling, funding this conflict right now. And as a consumer, I want a way to get ethical technology. It's not that I want divestment from Congo, because Congo needs investment. But I want it to happen in an ethical way. So companies that are operating there, they're not working within the corruption, they're not buying from militias, and they're operating to their industry's best practice. So typically in my job, what I do is I work in post-conflict countries, and this is the first time that I ever worked in an active conflict area. And basically, I'm going to play the news clip for you guys that made me decide to go to Congo. So I tend to focus on women and children's issues because they bear the brunt of conflict and they rebuild the country most of the time and you don't hear from them. And I knew about the Congo for several years, but I just, you know, I never got a job to go there. And it was kind of all these excuses. And then I heard this next news clip and it was my enough moment. I said, I can't sit by anymore as a woman and see this happening and not try to do something to end it.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Last week, aid groups reported Rwandan and Congolese rebels took over village. In the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and gang raped almost 200 women and 5 young girls. The rapes occurred between July 30th and August 3rd within miles of a UN peacekeeping base. The humanitarian group that documented the rapes, International Medical Corps, said aid and UN workers knew the rebels had occupied the villages soon after it happened, and they notified the United Nations about the attacks on August 6th, but it's taken the UN nearly 3 weeks to respond. A joint UN human rights team has now confirmed the rapes of 154 women. On Wednesday, the top UN official in Congo, Roger Meece, said peacekeeping forces could not have prevented the rapes because they did not know they were happening.
Okay.
So when I heard this news report, I know the volume was low in the beginning, but it said that two groups of rebels had taken over a village, and the aid groups had let the UN know. And for over a week, the soldiers held this village hostage, and they gang-raped 200 women and 5 girls, and the UN never responded. And I was totally outraged, so I decided I have to do something. So right away, I started emailing everyone I could think of to try to find a connection to get into the Congo, because you have to be invited. You can't go on your own. And I was able to find a connection to a Congolese nonprofit through a friend's cousin who was able to invite me into the country to host me and tell the government, okay, you know, we'll watch out for this person. And then, so the reason I call it my dream assignment is, even though I heard the story and I was outraged, I didn't buy my ticket right away. And then I had a nightmare that I was supposed to go to the Congo. So I woke up, you know, covered in sweat, twisted in my sheets, and I bought my ticket to go. And then I made the connection with the nonprofit. So on the end of this video, when you see us riding on the dirt bike, we were on our way to go meet these women. So I had worked really hard to get to this point, and on the way to meet them to do our first interviews, I realized, oh my God, maybe none of them are going to want to talk to me because I'm an outsider, you know, and there's such a stigma around rape. They may not be willing to share their stories. And so when we met them, I had to go through a translator because we went Kinandi to French to English and then back again. And I wanted to make sure that I had permission from all the women, that they were clear on what I was doing. And after we did this a few times, the woman that was the main spokesperson said, you know, I need to tell your friend something, translate something for me. And she said, we're all here because we want to talk to you, but you have to make us a promise. And so I was a little nervous, you know, what she was going to ask me. And I said, okay, you know, what is it that I need to promise you? And she said, you have to promise that you'll take this back to your country and share it with everyone you can find so that the world can know the extent of our suffering. Because these women and girls in these isolated communities, they have no way to protect themselves. There's no justice system. And the people in general living in these communities feel that the world has forgotten about Congo and that they have no idea what's going on there. They know the world's coming in and taking their resources, but they feel that the world has totally written them off. So the next video that I'm going to play is, it's a Congolese American, and he does spoken word, and he gives the most succinct breakdown that I've ever heard of the situation in Congo.
The world's richest country, now the poorest. A chorus of women's cries across a corrupted country in demise. International lies hide the truth of our turmoil, raping our country of our women, tungsten, coltan, and gold. Young girls now a commodity. It's no longer an oddity. Child soldiers watching bullets and not birds fly over their sky so that we can sit pretty with our PlayStations, laptops, and iPhones. I roam alone across Africa's First World War, starving a country, feeding the globe. Little babies dying so we can have a cell phone and warm home. An Xbox, a TV, a computer, a flat screen, flatlining the dreams of millions of Congolese, never quite able to control their destiny. Mineral gifts turn to curses. Body bags with no hearses. Babies bouncing from the womb to the tomb in a matter of minutes. But in a minute, you can decide to help turn this tide. Raise your voice for the people. Raise hope for the Congo. Turn your cell phone into a microphone and speak knowledge to your college. Tell these computer companies that we need conflict-free products. Realize you're a fool if you don't check the trail of those jewels. You see, diamonds and gold be the fuel to this fire. How can gold become a cancer? I'm searching for an answer in a land where diamonds are not a girl's best friend. But together, working with the Congolese, we can change this direction. If we all decide to raise our conscience and each one teach one, reach one in your grasp and make an army of change, an army of conscious consumers and not soldiers for the same old sympathetic solutions to political and profitable prostitution. The true resolution is empowering our women. The center of our land must be made whole once again. The backbone of our nation must be realigned. When our women can stand proudly, our country will once again have its spine. The pride of of our future lies in our young boys. The heart of our future lies in our young girls. Congo's future is in all of our hands if we just understand that we're all in this together. So let's all raise hope and take a stand for our land.
So what I love about this is, maybe as an artist he would have said, what can I do for the Congo? But he took his unique skills that he has and said, I'm going to do something to help raise awareness. And we'll get into that later, but that's something that I would ask each of you to do. You know, I don't know what your industry is or if you're a student, but what could you personally bring to the table to raise awareness? And the point is, it's not this distant conflict that we have no connection to. We have a very direct link. And if, you know, you're holding your cell phone or your iPad right now, it's in your hand, and we use it every day. It's a really integral part of our existence. So I just wanted to give a little bit of a breakdown of some statistics that maybe you've heard, but it's difficult to put them into perspective. So what's happening there? So it's been referred to as Africa's World War, and what happened in 1996 was that Rwanda and Uganda led a multi-country invasion, and then once they went into the Congo, they raided the refugee camps because they went in under the guise of, we have to go in and retrieve the genocidaires that have escaped to the Congo. And they went in and absolutely slaughtered everyone, including the civilians in the refugee camps. And then, amongst themselves, they went to the mining areas and began to fight over those. So the people living in Congo are living among multiple rebel groups. And in November of 2010, there were 29 armed groups that were fighting. Some of them are with the government, some of them are community militias, and a lot of them are from other countries, proxy armies. And it's called the Third Congo War, but it's not even technically a war. And a lot of times you hear it referred to as an ethnic conflict, and it's really, I would say, it's a resource war, and the reason it's fought along ethnic lines is because ethnicity is the only stable institution that exists after years of breakdown of the government and years of war. And then early on, as a military strategy, rape as a weapon of war was used purposefully, and now, just because society has been broken so bad and people are living among these multiple military groups, it's not necessarily a strategy, but a way of life. Like, if you're a man, a civilian, you know, or a military, a lot of them rape. And so I just wanted to put the numbers into perspective. So 5.4 million people have died. So that's as many people as the Cambodian and the Rwandan genocides combined, and that's more people than any war since World War II. But yet we really haven't heard much about it. And this number is only an estimate. There's no official numbers. Some people think it could be as many as a million more people that have died. So how many is 5.4 million? I wanted to see if I can make it more tangible. So if we took the city of Los Angeles, the city of Austin, the city of Portland, and the city of Seattle, and completely wipe them off the map, every single person. That's the number of people that we're talking about. And this is still going on. So something that was really important to me when I was there was to just go beyond the numbers and the stereotypes and learn people's individual story. So a statistic that maybe you've heard is that 58% of people have been displaced from their homes. So roughly that would mean, I'll let you three over there go home tonight, and the rest of you, everything's taken away from you. Your cell phone, your car, your credit cards, your house, you're robbed of everything, and there's no place that you can go because your neighbors have been robbed too, and you have to hide in the bush. So this woman was sleeping in her house. The majority of people in Congo are cultivators. Only 4% of people are quote-unquote employed, where someone else pays them. Most people farm their crops and then sell things at the market. So the soldiers came in, and they took everything she had, her plates, her utensils. They took all of her crops, which meant they took her food and her money. and then they raped her. They came back and stole the clothes that she was wearing, and then they left her in her house. So to the left of where she's sitting, her house, it's like one of those mud huts, it's there in the background, is right underneath this hill that the Congolese, one of the battalions of the Congolese government army, is permanently camped on top of. And then we also have other Rwandan and Ugandan proxy armies and rebel groups that come into this area. So not only are they subject to these raids by their own military, but to these rebel groups. And a lot of the reason why these rebel groups raid, originally it was to break down the community and overpower them, but now it's to punish communities if they help the other side. And it's also because the soldiers aren't paid. So the Congolese government is really bad about paying its civil servants. That's why there's no security sector, basically. And so the soldiers, they have families and they need to eat. So if you're not getting any food and your child is sick and you have nothing, this is what the soldiers are reduced to, is raiding other people's houses so they can survive. Another statistic is that one girl or woman is raped every 90 seconds. And that was something that as a woman outraged me and drew me to the Congo, because I feel no matter what context it's in, it's wrong, especially this day and age. And so what you don't hear is that 65% of the women and girls that are raped are adolescent girls. They're under 16. And about 10% of those are not even teenagers. They're small children. So these girls and women have no way to protect themselves because there's no functioning security sector, and there's no recourse because there's no justice system. So they're at risk every day when they're going to get water, when they're going to get firewood, and when they're going to their fields to cultivate. So all the things that you need to do to stay alive, they're constantly at risk, and there's no one protecting them at all. And then one in four people know one who suffered sexual violence. And this is one of the few men that I spoke to. The women were much more open to sharing their stories. And the men, it's an interesting situation. You know, there is a big sense of shame because since a lot of them are unemployed and they kind of can't economically provide for their families, but as well, if your wife is raped and you couldn't protect her, it's very demasculating, you know, and it's embarrassing for them. So this man, he was outside of his house, and he knew his wife was inside, and he saw three soldiers enter, and he saw that they had guns, and he heard his wife screaming, and he heard the entire rape. There was nothing he could do, because he knew that if he went into the house, that they would kill him. So he had to sit outside the entire time. He's a really religious man, so he said that he prayed, and the way that he's, you know, reconciled it as sort of a good and evil, and it was something that was from the devil. But he said it's been very difficult. There's no such thing as counseling services in these remote areas, so people are really left to deal with it on their own. And the first time that he and his wife tried to be together intimately after the rape, they both cried. He said, "We cried like babies because they were so scared." You know, there's just nowhere to process this, and it's something that you have to hide and keep very private. And that's why, as a strategy, it was very effective for breaking down these communities, because you're showing the men, you know, well, you're showing the community, we have power, we're going to do what I want. They're ruling by fear. And then you're showing the men, you can't care for your community and you can't care for your women. So I just wanted to go over who's doing the fighting. And if you looked at a list of the armed groups in Congo, it could literally take three pages. So this is just a small breakdown. But we have the Congolese government troops, the local militias, they're the Mai Mai, so they're formed more along ethnic lines because people tend to live in ethnic communities because of the old chiefs and tribal system. You have Rwandan proxy armies, Ugandan proxy armies. So those aren't necessarily the national military of the country. They're militaries that were hired. And then you have hired mercenaries from all around the world. And that was something that was really shocking to me. Literally people from Lebanon, Israel, Serbia, the former Yugoslavia. I mean, there's people from all around the world. Some of them work for the UN. There's a lot of private mineral runners there, people that fly commuter, quote-unquote commuter airplanes that do carry commuters, but they also smuggle minerals. There's an enormous black market, and it's definitely not something that's just Congo. The rest of the world is very active there. So proxy armies from all 9 of the countries surrounding the Congo, a lot of times, because the Congo is so large, people say that it's like a sick elephant that's being torn apart by hyenas, because the countries on all sides are just slowly chewing away at the borders and whatever resource is across that border, be it copper, gold, diamonds, coltan, or oil. And so the Congolese government, instead of, you know, our idea of government is that it serves the people and we're willing to let them have power over us because in the end they're going to be, you know, benefiting and giving us structure in some way. But the Congolese government is really more about staying in power. Instead of being a formal system, it's more informal networks that really foster corruption, and it's based off of these parallel command structures and bribery. And that's true also when foreign businesses are doing business there. And then traditional, it's just a form of neocolonialism. So traditional United States, England, World Bank, Western NGOs, we, even though we know that Rwanda and Uganda are exporting more minerals than they actually contain in their own country, we continue to support them, and there's no impact on their aid programs or the military resources that we give them. So the United States and England tends to side in the World Forum with Rwanda and Uganda, and then Belgium and France tend to side with countries like Congo. And then the major mining corporations and banking corporations that have actually been named in several UN reports, the majority are American, Canadian, and European, and they're operating with little to no transparency and totally exploitative business practices. So a nonprofit that works on mining regulation was able to get a hold of one of these contracts, and the contract was so bad that before they had even signed the contracts, even though they'd taken out loans and put down deposit and given advances, they already had made back more than anything they put in just before they signed the contract. So nothing is going back to the people that are bearing the brunt of the burden, and nothing is going back to develop the country. And I wanted to put into perspective the size of the Congo, so we all know relatively how large the U.S. is. It's roughly a quarter the size of the United States. And this makes it extremely difficult to manage because it also has the second largest swath of rainforest left in the world. So a lot of the country is impenetrable jungle. So it's 2.5 million square miles with only 300 miles of paved roads. And that's part of what I didn't understand, is why can't the UN just go to these places? It's really difficult. Sometimes there's a road, and the roads are so bad that you pop your tires, your car breaks down every time you go somewhere. But then a lot of times to get to these communities, you're walking on small paths through banana fields. You'll see a little video later of what that's like. And a lot of people say that the Congo is a linchpin country for Africa, that if you could stabilize the Congo, you could stabilize Africa because of the resources that it has. So why is this happening? So these armies and businessmen are fighting over the minerals because it's, in the end, proliferating the small arms trade. So the money that militia groups get selling these minerals into the world market, they turn around and buy small arms, and that's what's continuing the fighting, and that's their major funding source right now. And the way they get into our electronics is they're just mixed into the world supply chain because there's no transparency in the supply chain right now. And it is something that's possible. It's very similar to the Blood Diamond movement that only happened once consumers demanded that they wanted to know they could get clean diamonds. So I'm going to play a little video for you called Conflict Minerals 101 that will give you the breakdown of the supply chain.
Hey, I'm John Prendergast of the Enough Project. I've been working on conflicts and in conflict zones in Africa for 25 years now. But I've never seen anything like the human devastation in eastern Congo. The violence there is worse than anywhere else in the world, the deadliest conflict in the world since World War II, and the highest rates of sexual violence in the entire world. But it's the most dangerous place to be a woman or a girl. And the direct connection between our consumer appetites and the violence in eastern Congo is a result of this, your cell phone. Basically, there are four minerals that come from the Congo that are in every one of our electronics products. Gold and what we call the three T's, tantalum, tin, and tungsten. Tantalum stores electricity in your phone. If you didn't have tantalum in your phone, tungsten makes your cell phone vibrate. And tin is used as a solder on circuit boards. Congo has a lot of tin. Gold is used to coat the wiring, and it's the highest value metal inside every cell phone and laptop. That's why we call them conflict minerals. So here's how minerals in the Congo get from the mine to your mobile phone. So basically, the armed groups in eastern Congo act like a mafia. The mines themselves are controlled and taxed by these armed groups, by these militias. And then the smuggling routes, as they're smuggled across the borders to neighboring countries, particularly Uganda and Rwanda, those smuggling points are all controlled by these armed groups. All these places, they're making huge amounts of money by taxing and stealing the resources and smuggling them out of the country illegally. And the tool of choice, the human rights violation of choice of the militias and armed groups in the Congo is rape, in order to intimidate populations and punish populations for supporting other groups.
When the minerals are smuggled out of Africa, they head to Asia to smelting companies in Thailand, Malaysia, China and India to be refined. Here, Congo's minerals get mixed together with other minerals from around the world, making them difficult but not impossible to trace. Finally, the three T's in gold are processed into components, and they end up all over the world in the products we know and love. Cell phones, BlackBerries, laptops, iPods, video game systems, and digital cameras.
So that's all the bad news. The good news is, because we have a direct role in fueling the violence, as innocent and inadvertent as it might be, we actually have a role in bringing it to an end. The first thing we need to do is to create a demand, a consumer demand for conflict-free products. We need to get in touch with our cell phone manufacturers and our laptop companies and tell them we want conflict-free products. After 5.5 million deaths in eastern Congo, when is enough enough? We can all help end the war in the Congo. It's your call.
And so I really don't think the point in all this is saying, oh, corporations are bad and, you know, they're the evil ones. I mean, I really think it's that things often change. If you look at maybe the environmental movement or what's happened in the food industry, when there is consumer pressure and when the consumers let industries know this is something that we want. And I think that ethical technology is only starting to come up in conversations because globalization just happened so fast and we're now learning the impacts. So if you're in the tech industry, this is what we're asking people to do. And I hope that when they come to you, you know that you won't feel attacked, but you'll be wanting to work with the customer to give them a product that they're looking for. So a UN report came out basically after the war in Congo exploded, and they wanted to find out what had happened. And they called all of the armies that went in armies of business. So they did go to the refugee camps, but then they began this fighting. And all of these red arrows are the countries that began taking out the minerals. So Rwandans and their allies brought in $20 million a month in coltan production. And these are older numbers from 2001, because since there's not an official war right now, it's gone very underground. It's much harder to know what's actually coming out. Uganda's diamond exports jumped from approximately 1,500 carats to about 11,300. And Rwanda's diamond exports went from 166 to 30,500. And it's well documented that these countries don't contain this amount of minerals in their soil. And like I mentioned, they haven't been held accountable by other countries that are providing aids or that have trade agreements with them. So I wanted to show you a map of where I was. So there's the city Butembo up there in purple. And that's where the nonprofit Koperma was based. And then the second one here is the second one that bounced out is where I stayed in the forest with a group of Catholic priests, because there's not really hotels there. It was one of the only safe places for me to stay. So I would ride along that dirt road every day for 45 minutes on a dirt bike to get to the nonprofit. And then when I got there, we would go out to these smaller diamonds, which are these isolated communities. And it's crazy on a map to see how close together it looks, because to get to the diamond Bulambo in the top right corner, it would take us about 2.5 to 3 hours one way. We would always pop two tires on the way there because the road was so bad. And it was always a race to get home before dark, because the rule about Congo, there is a certain level of danger during the day, but it's really at night that it becomes a soldier's playground. And so it was always a rush against time to try to make it. So Koperma, the nonprofit, what they do is they go out and they work with these communities where when a lot of people flee, they just kind of end up here, and these are communities that are willing to help girls or children that no longer have a family, or girls that have become pregnant from the rape, because a lot of times they're ostracized by their community and their family. And at the same time, they're also working with child soldiers that are trying to escape these multiple militaries. So I just wanted to tell you one story, and then I'm going to play you this video. So when we were driving home one night on this road, we had gone out to a Koperma center, and a way that they raise money to fund themselves is they plant potatoes, and then they take those potatoes and they sell them at the market. And someone had raided that field. So to them, this is hundreds of dollars that they need to continue their programs, and they need to continue their work to take people to the hospital and to give them post-rape treatment. So we had to stay in this field until dark, digging the potatoes out. And it wasn't like I could say, hey, I'm an American, I need to go home, you know, because I don't want to be on the road with the soldiers. So we ended up going home after dark, and everyone was really nervous. And they said, you know what happened on this road a month ago? The president, Joseph Kabila, the president of the country, was driving at night. He was stopped by his own soldiers and robbed. So that, I mean, that's the situation in the Congo. I mean, it's not that it's total chaos. It's that there's no functioning systems that work without corruption. So, of course, when they realized it was the president, they ran away. But, I mean, that's just the state of, you know, the government not working at all. So what I want to play for you is just a little bit of a rough cut of a short documentary that we're working on from my time there.
Yeah. côté du Congo. Le Congo est un beau pays, mais c'est la guerre qui amène la pauvreté. Le coltan, nous avons le coltan ici, auquel c'est une richesse que tous les pays du monde entier en veulent. Parce que ce sont eux qui connaissent l'importance de ces minéraux. Ils les transforment et nous revendent la matière finie. Et quand on veut arrêter même la vente de ces minéraux, c'est tous les pays du monde qui fait beaucoup de bruit. On se dit, est-ce que c'est les minéraux, on se bat contre les minéraux ou on se bat contre les personnes?
I traveled to the war-torn, mineral-rich region of North Kivu in the Democratic Republic of Congo. I stayed there in an effort to understand why over the past 15 years, hundreds of thousands of girls and women have been raped, and how conditions have become so bad that one girl or woman is raped every 90 seconds.
La violence sexuelle, c'est une arme que les belligérants, les associés du pouvoir, ont commencé à utiliser comme arme. C'est une sorte d'arme, ils cherchent à vouloir neutraliser les femmes pour qu'ils puissent peut-être gagner ou bien l'autre échouer.
Butembo is a bustling town of over 800,000. It's the center of the diamond and coltan trade for this region. Neighboring countries export diamonds and minerals each year, but only people involved in the mineral and diamond trade see a profit. The people hardest hit by the conflict for these minerals see almost nothing.
Les gens du Congo sont en train de dire que c'est à cause des téléphones que la guerre ne peut pas se terminer ici au Congo.
I worked with Coperma, a non-profit made up of everyday Congolese citizens. And none of them have any guarantee of a paycheck at the end of the month. But the workers of Coperma risk their lives every day. I think they feel that they have no choice. They have to forge ahead on their own if they want a better future for their children and their country. I also worked alongside American humanitarian Amy Ernst, who was working as Coperma's rape crisis counselor and a freelance journalist. Amy and Coperma would set up meetings in mud huts in rural villages where girls and women had recently been raped. We went there in order to collect their testimony and determine how Coperma could help them. In a mud hut, most days, we listen to the testimony of survivors.
There really is no system of recourse or collecting information in terms of what's happened to these women, specifically in terms of what's happened to individual women. So there's no system of justice really in place because there isn't an infrastructure to support it. The United Nations does try and keep track of the quantity of rapes that there are, and for example, how many soldiers a woman was raped by or which group of soldiers she was raped by, but it falls extremely short. For example, I spoke with several UN people the other day about a conflict in a village called Isale, and I was able to give them the information about seven of the women, but a lot more women were actually raped during that confrontation, and they didn't come forward. So the statistics are extremely skewed, and nobody's paying the price for what's happening here.
Goretti is a 21-year-old single mother that I met during my stay there. She lives in a small village outside of Butembo. 5 years ago, she woke up in the hospital at 16 years old. She was alone and afraid. 9 months later, she returned to the hospital to give birth to a daughter. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the word used to describe girls like Goretti is girl mother.
Mimi Goretti, mie maisha yangu nilikuwa kanapenda
maisha yangu kuwe mzuri. Na mie nikuwe saa wengine, niendelee mbele, maisha yangu kuwe bie sana. Njo vile nishaka shangala, maisha yangu nishaka haribika ovyo ovyo.
Jacqueline, mama Jacqueline.
Na nasikiaka lakini nasijue kama ni nini.
Mbisi anga yabuwa kondi bakaluwa na mundu. Iza bango mundu, ukaluwa yuhu nera. Kwa mfano, kwa tulio mubu nyumba, ukaluwa yuhu nera. Aa, iza mani kalako, ukibe webi yabuwa. Nero mundu kwa kahunati.
Ani chijua batu basijue, juu na juu batu mtu maisha juu acheneno mara mabote na watachijua. Nilisema kani tumara mwana stao lewaka tena na ndakuwaka batu wanakuwa na nichekelea.
Mdusi anga yabuga kwende bakaluwa na mundu, iva bango mundu, ukaluwa yuhu nera. Kwa mfano, ipe tulio mubu nyumba, ukaluwa yuhu nera. Aa. Hivya mani kalako, ukibe webi yebu. Nero mduku waka honakia.
Esa nilijuaka, nilipataka hoga. Nikeshangala. Ana nilizaka, arudi ana nilizaka atikama nae babaki, wengine bana mwambia kambuviko na papabu. Kama nae wake iko wapi. Na mbe nina mambia niti babake haiko. Mpana siyezi mambia. Juna, natakuwa kama chidonda.
Nimependa mamangu na tatiangu. Kwe mganga, juwa ganga wa matinjaka wa gonja.
An entire generation of brave and vulnerable girls forced into motherhood by rape. She and thousands of others are lovingly raising a generation of fatherless children. Despite the scars of war, I worked alongside everyday citizens who are working on a grassroots level towards enormous change.
Certaines femmes ont étudié, mais ils n'ont pas de poste de commandement. La guerre du Congo, les guerres du Congo sont faites par les belligérants, les assoiffés du pouvoir. Quand on est assoiffé du pouvoir, on fait enrôler derrière soi un troupe de militaires. Alors chaque belligérant en a au moins deux ou trois troupes de militaires qu'il est derrière lui. Et ce sont ces militaires qui font la guerre ici au Congo.
Les civils commencent à violer maintenant parce qu'ils sont en train de copier les militaires. Ils sont en train de copier les militaires et c'est ainsi que dans la société, les cas de violence sont devenus très nombreux et il n'y a pas la justice ici chez nous. Il y a l'injustice, la justice ne peut rien faire. Cette impunité amène aux civils aussi à continuer à faire la violence. Parce qu'ils voient que les militaires ne sont pas punis.
The testimony that haunts me the most was from the young girls. 13, 14, 15. Not only were they traumatized, many of their hopes for the future had been devastated. They were now stigmatized and most of them were blamed by their family for what had happened. The rape was considered their fault. No longer eligible for marriage, an angry 13-year-old put it to us, "What man would want me?" In this society, marriage not only means economic stability, it also means social standing, the ability to buy and sell land, and some level of protection. Without a husband to serve as the intermediary for society, women have no place, few rights, and little future. This young 13-year-old wasn't being overly dramatic. Her entire future had been devastated. Girls and women lined up for hours at a time to speak with Amy and to have me photograph them. It was their chance for justice, a single chance to share their story with the rest of the world, and they were not going to miss it. I witnessed resilient survivors seeking justice and security as they struggle to rebuild their lives.
Qui m'amène à continuer avec le travail, même avec ces dangers que j'ai eu, c'est par amour des autres, par amour des femmes. On ne sait pas ce qui se passe, on se demande la violence. Les hommes n'aiment pas les femmes, ce que je peux dire, les hommes n'aiment pas les femmes. Les hommes aiment toujours faire reculer l'intelligence des femmes. En faisant les violences auprès des femmes. Et on se tient dans cette frustration. Il nous faut un appui.
Women here rely a lot on a male figure in the family for sustenance, for security. That adding to the fact that they've already been raped and now are also going to have the child of their rapist just makes it really difficult. So they really are in need of the ability to take care of their families.
Il faut une sensibilisation des hommes et des femmes sur les genres et le développement. Cette sensibilisation consisterait même l'interchange entre villages. Parce que quand on est dans le même village, on ne peut pas se comprendre. On peut sensibiliser un village et un ou deux villages, et les femmes de ce village peuvent aller dans d'autres villages pour sensibiliser les hommes et les femmes. Si la prise en charge est le respect les droits de la femme.
Apprenticeships for trades like sewing and bread making and attending school. These communities are eager to better themselves, educate their children, and work for peace in their country. In order to feel empowered to do this, they need to know that the world has not forgotten about them. They need a chance to have the truth told.
So you guys just saw the world premiere of The Rough Cut. So there's actually one little audio glitch in here that was important. The woman, Goretti, that had the daughter who was born of rape, she was raped by 10 soldiers. But that part got cut out of there. So basically, this whole project was born out of my frustration of not being able to get people to listen. Because as a journalist, I thought, oh, well, you know, all my contacts are going to think that this is great. So I've worked with Wired Magazine, Time Magazine, Time International, Mother Jones, all of these magazines that you think would be interested in this issue. And my contacts said, this is great. Let me talk to my senior editor. And they all came back and said, we did a story on this 2 years ago. We did a story on this a year and a half ago. And all I could think was, but wait, I know, you know, that when we did the string of the younger girls, the 13, 14, 15, one of their friends was being held in a soldier's camp as a sex slave. And we couldn't get the UN to go there. The UN told us, oh, she's probably lying. And I couldn't get any of these magazines, even online, to pick up the story. So I decided, you know what, I'm going to turn this into art because people can't say no to art. It is what it is. So the handwriting that you see over the pictures are the notes that my friend Amy Ernst took when she was doing the interviews. And I would just lay those over the portraits. And what it's turned into is an interactive gallery show. It's going to travel the country as a pop-up show. And the catch is that you have to use your smartphone with QR codes to navigate it. Just so that people see our direct link. So I just have a few more things here, and we can go to a little Q&A. Okay, so why should you guys care? Why should you do something? Basically, you know, a lot of times when we hear about this, we feel helpless and we feel like, oh, there's nothing I can do. And then we feel some level of relief when we hear, oh, the United Nations is there, the World Food Program is there. But these girls and women are literally on their own. Absolutely no one is protecting them, especially not the UN. And so if anyone's going to do it, it's going to be me. It's going to be you. There's no one else. So if you have a woman in your life, you know, if you love your mother, if you love your sister, you would protect her. And I hope that you feel passionate about doing something to help raise awareness for these girls, because there's absolutely no one speaking out for them. And it's not to demonize the UN. It's just not within the mandate, the scope of their mandate. It's not within their ability to go out and protect all of these girls. So what I would really ask you guys to do is think of unique ways that you can leverage this through your personal and business network. So it could be as simple as, you know, sharing this project through your social media to begin to generate a conversation, but you may have some further connections. So I have a friend that found out about my project through my blog, and she happened to just get a job at Tom's Shoes. And Tom's Shoes has a huge giving program overseas because they take their profit and then they send an equal number of shoes overseas. So now we're looking at sending an enormous shipping container of shoes to Koperma. So I would love if you guys could start thinking along those lines, you know, what unique things could you bring to this community? So if you're in the tech industry, I want to show you what we're asking consumers to do. And if you're a consumer, these are the actions you can take. So this is on my Act Now resources page of the website. The website is thetruthtold.com. And you can go, these are all clickable links to sign petitions, take the conflict-free mineral pledge. And as well, there's toolkits. So if you're a university member, if you have a civic or religious community that you would like to make conflict-free, you can download the toolkits. And if you have questions about how you can be involved or, you know, how you can make it apply to your industry, I may not have the answer, but I'm happy to help you make the connection because I'm very connected within the advocacy community that's working for Congo. So this is a little girl, Waridi, who was born of the rape of 10 soldiers. And there's two paths that I see for her life. Right now, the path that she's on, we found someone to fund her next year of school, but after that, there's no guarantee that she can go to school. So the path she's on is she'll have a little education, she'll probably end up working in the fields like her mother, and she'll probably be raped at some point because the majority of women are raped on the like 3-hour commute to and from their field that they walk both ways, so they end up walking at night. Or the other option is we could find funding. People could become more involved in the Congo and really preparing a new generation as far as access to education, access to technology. And she said that her dream is that she wants to be a nurse. So I'd love to, you know, help her fulfill that dream and help her be able to go to school, go to university, and come back this empowered woman to her community to help her community. So the formula that we've come up with at the Truth Told Project is to address the cause. So what we're doing, we're making a very concerted effort to educate global consumers about what's going on so they can start requesting conflict-free products, more ethical technology, and then simultaneously addressing the symptom because there are immediate needs. So neither one of these will solve the problem on their own, but together they could create massive change. And we believe that that will equal the solution, which is empowering the next generation in Congo so they can write a new story for Congo and the next chapter. So, and, you know, like I mentioned before, we tend to have this guilt, like, oh, God, I mean, I even have it right now. This laptop is so old. I need a new one. And I'm, you know, just getting it till it won't go anymore because I do feel guilty. But I think the biggest thing that we can do is do something that will directly impact the people that are affected now, which means giving back by supporting these grassroots organizations. They're often far more effective than larger aid organizations because they're operating within a cultural context and they've lived the conflict. You know, they really have a vested interest. And so the last one is just a little plug for the show. So don't worry, you guys aren't going to miss it. You're going to be unable to miss it when it starts popping up in communities. I'm really excited about it. And hopefully our kickoff is going to be at the Genocide Walk in Los Angeles next month. And so, like I said, it's a technology-based gallery show. And we're definitely still looking for investors and partners. We're launching our Kickstarter campaign in a few weeks to finish raising the money to help it travel around the country. If anyone here happens to work for a cell phone company or a tech company that's interested in becoming the industry leader on this issue, because there's currently no industry leader, I would be more than happy to connect with you and help connect you with some other people working on this issue. I know that you must exist. We just haven't found you yet. So, you know, the biggest thing that I would ask of you is a lot of people say, oh, like, these are amazing stories and what amazing photography, and then they walk out of the room and they forget about it. So I would ask you to make me a promise to help me keep the one that I made to the women in these isolated communities, and that is, you know, either right now on your iPad or your laptop or the next time you turn it on, please go to the website, share it through your social networks, you know, share it with your work, and complete the resources page, the links and the petitions, and don't forget about it. Keep talking about it so that we can have the truth told about what's going on in Congo. So I'll go ahead and take questions if you guys have any. Yeah?
First of all, the photos were absolutely gorgeous.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
And all of the scrutiny came and they kind of grew too big for the bridges too quickly. And I'm wondering what your, first of all, your take on that is, and if you guys are planning on doing any media like that, that tells a story and obviously can have a viral effect with people sharing what's going on. Because I think part of the problem is nobody knew that was going on.
Right.
So people started sharing it through social networks. So how how can we legitimize that strategy? Because I know that some of the criticism was that those gentlemen, not the whole story wasn't maybe as truthful as it
is. Yeah, well, I think what it is, and I did mention that in the beginning, I don't know if you heard that, but there is, for all of these situations, there's no silver bullet. I mean, there's few things in life that have, like, the one thing that will change everything. And I think their point was, so for the Kony 2012, it's that he's the number one person on the International Criminal Court list. And their only point is, let's hold this guy to account and prove to other people like him that we will no longer accept this. And a lot of people within, like, the Uganda and Africa community were upset because they took their message to say, you know, we're going to end, this will end all of the problems in Uganda, which isn't true. And I think traditional nonprofits have a problem with their marketing because while I feel it is extremely effective and making a huge difference, it's a little propaganda-ish. And they've been really effective. Other people get jealous. They've been working on this issue for years. And these guys, within 48 hours, raised more awareness than anyone's done in 20 years. And that's something kind of, you know, when you're looking at becoming involved in movements and donating to these international organizations that are working in other countries, you have to personally decide what's important to me. So me personally, I would rather see change. So I would support something like the Kony 2012 campaign, as opposed to maybe another organization that's been operating there for 20 years, and they're just doing the minimum. I mean, our system of aid doesn't work, or we wouldn't have given millions of dollars of aid to Africa with so little change. You know, so there's these other people that, sure, maybe they have a low overhead and they're giving a lot back, but in the end, what kind of positive change and growth are their services really giving? So I hope that answered your question. Anyone else?
Yeah, to what extent do you think there is any sort of political solution? Is Kabila complicit in a lot of this? Do people, have they lost faith in the political process? Or do you think that there's an opportunity for someone, like, are people campaigning on this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so I strongly feel that in any country, it is never the position of another country and to go in to implement something for the people of that country. I believe that the only effective, lasting change can come from within movements built and led within that country. But at the same time, the part that we can play is our international business practices through mining and banking, and as well our aid practices and what we support. So, for example, we continue to support Rwanda and Uganda. We also have aid packages to the government of Congo, which would be Joseph Kabila, and then the people that operate kind of in his parallel structures. And so we're giving them aid and helping them, but we're not really holding them accountable with how they spend the money. And it's never reaching the people that are kind of in the lowest rungs of society, because it's this very exclusive system that only stays within the most wealthy and powerful business people. So there is a lot of political pressure as far as calling for envoys, calling for us to look at what we're doing aid-wise with these other countries and the Congo. Does that answer? Yeah. I'll go you first. Yeah, so the Frank Dodd bill was passed, and it was just an act within the bill that is calling for transparency within mining. So it's not saying that you cannot use conflict minerals. It's saying that companies need to let you know if they're conflict minerals. And at this point, so when I talked about, you know, we need to change the story of the way that we do business. So when the SEC, when it came out that they were going to implement these regulations, the Better Business Bureau said, if you do this, we're going to sue you. You know, that was their response, not, oh, we want to help our companies clean up the supply chain and stop funding this war. We're going to sue you for implementing this legislation. So it has passed, and it's very symbolic at this point because there's no way to implement it. There's companies that are interested, and they do want their mining practices to be more transparent and ethical, but there's no regulations for them to follow at this point. It's a really exciting time in Congo because there's a lot happening and a lot changing, but at this point it's very symbolic. And that's true of California just passed some conflict mineral legislation, and I think Boston recently did or is going to in the next few months. And all of that is a pledge that when there is the option to buy electronics that are conflict-free, that will be California State's first option. They'll go with the manufacturer that can certify it. And then you had a question? Yeah, I mean, it's all really different. I mean, all around Africa and the developing world, there's a lot of used cell phones. I had a pretty rocking, like, gold Nokia when I was there. That was this big one. But, I mean, a lot of times they're stripped, but I think in general it's a pretty inefficient use of minerals. That's something that I've been doing personally. So I need a new cell phone, I need a new laptop, but instead of going out and buying the new one when it comes out, I'm gonna buy the old generation and buy one that's used because I feel like, well, it's gonna be discarded. At least I can be a little more ethical, but that's just me personally. And then I think I probably only have time for one or two more. Yeah, it has 80% of the world's coltan, so there's a few other places. Yeah, but most likely the majority of people in the room, your iPads, cell phones, and laptops, you know, minus maybe two of you, it has coltan from the Congo. Thank you for bringing that up. And it also has gold, which is the most high valuable mineral in there, and the fighting in the Congo shifts depending on market prices, and it's very easy to track that and prove that. Anyone else? Okay, we got to wrap it up. We already went over, but thank you so much for your time, you guys. So please be sure to rate this session so I can get some positive reviews on the South by Southwest app that you have on your phone. And then also please visit the website and share it with your friends. Thank you so much. And and you can also sign up for our email list, too, on the contact section, or drop your business card with me. Thank you. Perfect, thanks. Do you want one of mine too? Cool. Who do you work for? Cool. Oh, awesome. Great.
Thank you.
It's
like, I usually like hang out with my wife.
I know. So nice to meet you. Thanks so much. Hey, how are you? Did I give you one of my cards already? Okay, cool. I am, yeah. I'm not sure. I'm looking at August, but it's not guaranteed. I'm basically waiting to see if the funding came through.
So what I want to do is go back and follow up with people and kind of follow their stories and see what's happening in their life. Yeah, and hopefully I'm going to start replicating this in other countries. So I'm looking at like Chad and Sudan right now. So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you can start the movement in England. Sure, that'd be awesome. I always need help. Well, it's really hard, you know, to do things on your own. I really believe you need to work with other people to stimulate your creativity, so. It is. I totally agree. Well, that's just our rough cut that's hopefully going to end up being like a 30-minute documentary for some film festivals. So I was like baptism by fire and learned editing. And then I just had a guy come in to do some of the finish, but it's still not all the way there. Like, there's still glitches that need to be worked out, so. Yeah, I need to start, well, after we launch a Kickstarter campaign, part of our campaign is to raise money to go in and do, like, high-end color correction and, you know, like, finish editing and all of that stuff. So, yeah.